This is the game changer for our economy. Tax reform does so much to fix those problems. And that's why we are all in on this. We are unified on this. We're excited about this.
That's House Speaker Paul Ryan talking about the Republicans' tax plan on CNBC. He sounds excited, but how should you be feeling? Today, we'll get a breakdown from some financial experts. And if you live near SIU in Carbondale, you've probably heard of Winston's Bagels and the Bagel Man.
Okay, it's going to be $2.75 of your hard-earned money, please. All right, honey, here's one with no cucumber or onion.
Yes, sir.
Winston is retiring after 34 years. We'll be talking to him and the new Bagel Man carrying his legacy forward. Plus, a partial version of President Trump's travel ban on six majority Muslim countries will go into effect. And today we ask, how are universities handling this? That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. The latest news is next. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Tomorrow is a big day in Washington for Republican lawmakers. They're going to be voting on their highly controversial new tax plan, one that's even more so thanks to the late addition Tuesday when several Senate Republicans said they plan to include a repeal of the individual payer mandate, part of the Affordable Care Act, as part of their attempt to overhaul taxes. This, they say, would allow to pay for many of the tax reductions in the bill. As we know, the GOP has had a hard time passing much of their agenda, including a repeal of the ACA, even with majorities in both chambers and a president from their own party. This is, needless to say, a crucial vote. At first glance, both the House and Senate plans contain huge potential changes, but how will that affect us here in Illinois? That's what we're going to talk about right now. And joining us to help parse the always complicated world of taxes are American tax policy expert and University of Illinois law professor Richard Kaplan. He's on the line from Urbana, from Lincolnshire, that's just northwest of Chicago, financial planner Tammy Wenner's with us with RW Financial Planning. Richard, Tammy, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Richard, let's start with you. As you look at both the House and Senate versions of this plan, who would see the biggest changes to their wallets?
There are so many moving parts that is difficult to assess, but probably people in the upper 20% of the income strata are going to see the most changes in both directions, deductions lost, tax rates lowered. People in the other 80% or so are going to have some major simplifications in terms of losing exemptions and a higher standard deduction. They may or may not see lower rates. It's going to very much depend on how it shakes out and whether they have high medical expenses, for example, or pay high property taxes.
So we'll sort through all of that. I think a large part of this question, Tammy, I'm hoping you can jump in here, is when we talk about the middle class, the largest share of taxpayers affected. First, I'm wondering, how are we defining middle class? What are the income limits on that?
Absolutely. And so it somewhat depends on what studies you look at in terms of what actually does define the middle class. You know, sometimes you'll see studies that show an average of $75,000 might be considered and middle class. On the other hand, the U.S. Census Bureau in 2016 showed the average median income at about $59,000. So it depends on the study that you're looking at.
And in terms of the bill, Richard, can you give us a sense of how the bill defines middle class? Or is there probably not even a definition of middle class in the bill? It's just sort of income exemptions, correct, Richard?
Yeah, the bill never uses terms like middle class, upper class. Most Americans define middle class as an income level going up to about where they are, and upper class is just above them. But most of the changes in the bill affect itemizers, and 84% of American taxpayers do not itemize their deductions right now. They would actually find that percentage going up. And so as a consequence, it's really people who make more than $100,000 who are the primary sources of itemized deductions, and they're going to be the ones that see the biggest changes. The other category are people who own small businesses. They're going to have some significant tax reductions, once again, pretty much regardless of their level of income, though many of the specific incentives are targeted at small businesses with less than $150,000 of net income.
Let's go through some of those if we can, Richard. You mentioned medical expenses. For people who itemize for medical expenses, what kind of changes would we see?
Well, the House and Senate are radically different there. The House bill would eliminate the medical expense deduction, which already is fairly limited. It only covers unreimbursed expenses, that is, expenses that you don't have health insurance to cover, and even then there's a 10% of income floor. The biggest group of people who have these kinds of expenses are disabled folks and older people who are in nursing homes without long-term care insurance and therefore pay their bills. That as a consequence, those people tend to deduct medical expenses. The House bill would eliminate that provision in its entirety. The Senate, it's not really a bill yet, it's more of a concept paper. The Senate version would keep that.
And when we think about things like home ownership or families, let's start with families first. Tammy, what would it look like in terms of parents and children and deductions?
And for folks in Illinois, that's a big question right now, given that we are one of the states that has higher property taxes. So, again, to Richard's point, given that a relatively low percentage of individuals actually itemized right now, for those that own homes, they may not even miss the deduction for property ownership because they will now simply take the standard deduction. But for individuals that are paying higher property taxes and for whom their property taxes and their local taxes will be greater than the standard deduction, it remains a question as to whether or not and how much they actually benefit or have a loss in terms of having to pay more tax.
Richard, it sounds like it's a little muddied, especially between the House and Senate version for property taxes. And as Tammy mentioned, we do have pretty high property taxes here in Illinois. Do you think that potentially this might change the way people are thinking about deductions and itemizing?
That's one possibility, as Tammy indicated. Most people have to do the math and basically see, do they come out ahead with the standard deduction, which both bills plan to increase substantially, or would they be better off actually keeping their records and filing an itemized return? Most people will find, as is in the case in the past, it's better off to just take the standard deduction. The bigger impact that is really unknown is whether people will complain to their state and local governments about the level of their taxes, in the sense that at least previously they could deduct them against their federal income tax liability. Now it looks like many, particularly the state income tax, is not going to be deductible, and so that might prove even more resistance to increasing state income taxes. That effect, which is not proven, of course, is actually part of the Republican Party's plan. They have been on the idea that there should be no federal subsidy of state and local taxes from almost 50 years ago. And the idea is that this anesthetizes state and local taxpayers against state and local tax increases. And so there is a goal that they would ask their state and local governments to reduce those taxes. So what many people would see as a bug in the system, they actually see as a feature.
Let's talk about this in broad terms of, Richard, you mentioned sort of the wealthy, and then I think we have categories in this country of wealthy and extremely wealthy or uber wealthy. What does that look like? You mentioned that there will be more deductions, but then also more taxes. On a broad level, when you look at both of these bills, Richard, will the extremely wealthy, the highest income Americans, be paying more or less?
The provision that benefits them the very most is the elimination of the estate and gift tax. The estate tax affects less than 2 out of 1,000 people who die, but those tend to be the very wealthy people. And in the House bill, that estate tax would be eliminated in its entirety. The Senate would keep it, but double the exemption so that it would apply only to married couples who leave more than $20 million. That is the provision that is the most targeted. Other provisions, such as the so-called pass-through rate, is going to apply to people who own their own businesses, and that gives them a tax rate of 25% rather than 40%. And that is going to be a huge reduction as well for many people, for example, President Trump, who has extensive businesses through partnerships and other sort of pass-through entities.
And Timmy, when we're looking at the very poor, how would there be changes on that end? So we were going from the top end to the opposite end.
A couple of things with that. Again, you know, as Richard mentioned, the doubling of the standard deduction will obviously benefit many of those families. And in addition, both plans right now continue with the earned income credit. So that will continue to benefit those individuals. And also the child credit will be increasing as well. So under the House plan, that will be increasing from $1,000 to $1,600. And under the Senate plan, actually with the amendment that they came out with, I believe yesterday, it increases it to $2,000. So for lower income families, they may actually see some tax savings from the proposed plan.
And Richard, does that depend on either version of the plan, or is that both versions of the plan?
Well, it is not a huge focus of this tax bill. That is because many low and poor people, income people, do not pay income taxes. It's just a reality that between the exemptions and now the increased standard deduction, the numbers that Governor Romney had used several years ago, about 47% of Americans don't pay any income tax, that has changed a little bit, but it's still pretty close to that. For nearly three out of four Americans, they pay much more in Social Security and Medicare taxes, the so-called payroll tax. And so they're sort of the forgotten people in this process. The income tax is not a big burden, and for many people it's a non-existent burden. For many wage earners of income up to about $45,000 or so, what they're concerned with is the payroll tax. And as Tammy indicated, the earned income tax credit ameliorates some of that burden. All these other provisions are really just noise to them. What they would be more interested in is a reduction in the payroll tax.
And then we mentioned corporations. And Richard, you mentioned small businesses. Tammy, can we start with small businesses? How will small businesses be affected by what's being proposed here?
So small businesses right now will have somewhat of a bifurcation between how they will be taxed in terms of whether or not the small business owner is actually working in the business. And so some of their income may be treated or will continue to be treated as ordinary income, but some of the income that is attributable to their capital contribution will be taxed at a 25% rate. And so there might be some benefit to those small businesses. But again, it's not going to benefit all small businesses. And so once the final details are released, I think a lot of businesses will be going back and taking a look at how they're structured and how the income is going to be allocated.
And Richard, we've heard about small businesses, but we've also heard a lot about the corporate tax rate. And I wonder if you can explain a little bit about how that is a part of this proposal.
Well, one aspect is very straightforward, namely, what is the corporate tax rate and what is it going to be? And the current corporate tax rate is 35%, but very few companies pay that because of various offsetting deductions. The current bills lower it to 20%. That looks like a big change. It is a huge change. The real question that economists have never been able to figure out is who will that really benefit? There are some who contend that a big portion of that benefit will flow through to workers. Others say it'll be passed on to customers. And it seems that the predominant theory is that, for the most part, that is a savings to shareholders.
Well, and Richard, I wanted to ask you about that. As someone who is a tax expert, we've often heard a Republican rationale for cutting taxes, not just for corporations, but for wealthy people, is that this will prompt them to invest more money into the economy by hiring more people or starting more businesses. I think lots of folks are familiar with President Reagan's sort of trickle-down economic theory. I don't know if you see that as what this is and if you think that will happen.
It's often very difficult to sort of trace that variable because there's so many other things that are going on in the world in terms of the price of energy and what other countries do. But there's no doubt that there's some feedback effects and that it stimulates economic activity. We've already seen some of that in the stock market, more what they call the expressive theory, namely that you've indicated that we're going to be business friendly and that that can have a very positive attitude. In terms of the actual impact, the fact of the matter is if you don't need a new machine, they're not going to buy one simply because you can get faster depreciation on it.
Let me ask you one last question. Richard, this last minute edition of the repeal of the individual payer mandate, that's, of course, the requirement that everyone have insurance. There's the math and the politics to this. First, I just want to ask you about the math. How much would this save the government in terms of why Republicans have added this into the plan? Let's leave the politics out of it, just the math part of this first.
No, it's a good question because that's really the main reason that it's there, and that is that the budget resolution passed last month indicated that this tax reform process can't lose more than $1.5 trillion over 10 years. And what they found as they're going through and various interest groups are complaining is that it looks like the tax bill is going to lose more than that, so they want to find some extra money to make it balance. And the prediction, according to the Congressional Budget Office, and they don't really disclose how they come up with this, is that it would produce about $340 billion over 10 years. That would be a large hunk of change that they can use to offset some of the tax cuts in other parts of the bill.
Right. And of course, this is in regards to health insurance. The politics of this, as we know, is anyone's guess, particularly with this edition of the repeal of the individual payer mandate, which has been a clear part of ACA, which we've seen some Republican lawmakers say that they, particularly on the Senate side, would already oppose. Tammy, just if this does pass, when would this take effect?
Next year.
So this would take effect in 2018 for people filing. So then people filing 2019 for 2018 taxes?
Yep, that's my understanding of it.
Well, and as we'll see all of this hopefully play out tomorrow, I want to thank Tammy Wenner. She's with RW Financial Planning in Lincolnshire and University of Illinois law professor, U.S. tax policy expert Richard Kaplan, for joining us, explaining a little bit more about this, especially its effect on Illinois. Richard, Tammy, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Listening to the 21st. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Ever since President Trump first banned travelers to the U.S. from seven majority Muslim countries in January, that executive order and two other different versions of it have been fought through various levels of our court system. On Monday, the latest development, a federal appeals court allowed the government to enforce parts of the travel ban. So people visiting from six countries, Iran, Libya, Chad, Syria, Yemen, and Somalia. And let's be clear, people who have no direct ties to the U.S. can now be stopped from entering the country. There are more than 50,000 international students enrolled in schools across Illinois. And so today we wanted to see not just how Illinois universities are responding to this with faculty and staff, but how this affects international students, especially with recruit and support during this first year under the Trump administration. Martin McFarlane is the director of International Students and Scholar Services at the University of Illinois. He joins us from our Urbana studio. Yiming Wong is associate director of the Office of International Studies and Programs at Illinois State. She's joining us from our partner station, WGLT in Normal. Martin, Yiming, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Martin, let's start with you. As we're first few months into the full academic year under the Trump administration, we've seen so much news related to people from other countries coming here. Has your job felt different this year?
Very much so, yes. We have been put into an interesting role where we are having to explain new policies, new procedures with very little advance warning. It's a new day. Every time we come in, we check the news, we see what's coming out, because these executive orders often happen with very little warning. I mean, this change on Monday, you never know when the courts are going to do something. And I have to say, I think that's been the biggest issue on campus for us, is there was initially anger at a lot of these changes felt by our students, our international faculty, staff, and scholars. And that anger, while still existing, I feel has turned into frustration. Internationals understand that while they're in the United States, there are certain rules and regulations they have to follow, and they just want to know what those are. And without being able to give certainty as to what's coming, they aren't able to plan as their travel, they aren't able to plan their futures. And for our office, that is also a source of frustration, because we pride ourselves in being the office that supports international students and tells them and assists them in things that they can and can't do in the United States. And we haven't been able to do that particularly effectively this year.
Martin, as you say that, we spent quite a bit of time this morning actually going through, just the producers, all of the different news of the travel, the different iterations of the travel ban, and making sure we had sorted the accurate information of what was implemented now versus what had previously been. So we're professional journalists whose job is to sort of distill all of this out for people. So when you speak of frustration, Yemin, I wonder at ISU, as Martin talked about anger and frustration, what are you seeing and how are you feeling about this?
Well, you know, I came to United States as an international student. So was Martin, I know. I used to work for U of I. So ISU has a smaller number of international students compared to U of I. So I remember when the first travel ban was issued back in January, we started to action on that Sunday. And we came back to office and went through the news, worked with our partners at professional organizations such as NAFSA, International Educators Organization, sit down with our legal general counsel, provost office, communications department to try to get out the information as timely as possible, and also try to get the tips and strategies to advise students in a very timely manner. And that Sunday afternoon, our university president released the first announcement regarding this travel ban, ensuring students at Illinois State University is committed to be a safe, secure, and inclusive environment. So we were all very encouraged by this message, and we joined force with various units on campus, including counseling center, housing, health, and wellness, to ensure at this very challenging moment how we can all work together and top up our services for international students.
And Yemin, it sounds like you've had to do that several times, though, right? Because you're
right.
Just talking about January, and there's been several iterations of this. Have you all established at this point pretty good communication across, at least for your international students, updating them about the latest changes as they happen?
Right, yes. Every time there was a change, our legal office will work with our provost office and us to write up the announcement and the news release, and we try to put it on our website as soon as possible, and then also communicate with our international student advisors. The majority of our international students are graduate students, so even with graduate school and graduate coordinators on how to advise students. Some students might be impacted by the travel ban, but a lot of times it's more of that perception and the sentiment. So, NAFSA, the International Educators Association, has initiated a campaign on You Are Welcome Here for international students. We joined the force and try to create that inclusive, caring, and also encouraging environment for international students. But of course, sometimes we would get phone calls from some professors or graduate coordinators about inquiries from students in the countries that are impacted.
Right, so, and what are you saying to those students in particular?
Well, depending on what are their visa status, how far along in their application process, there are a lot of individualities there. So what is really important is for us as international educators to get the thorough and detailed knowledge and being able to advise students both really down to earth and give them factual and reasonable advice, but also try not to discourage them. So that is always a tricky balance that requires the knowledge, the care, and also a lot of collaborations with the experts in the fields and also with the other units on campus.
That's Yimin Wong. She's the Associate Director of the Office of International Studies and Programs at ISU in Normal. Martin McFarlane is with us as well. He's the Director of the International Studies and Scholars Program at the U of I. Martin, as you're hearing Yimin talk about the tricky balance that goes that played out here, I can't help but think of what she also talked about, the perception and the sentiment. And while there may be campaigns and universities saying you're welcome here, how do you all balance that with what the political climate is, Martin?
Well, I mean, that's that's a very good question, because as much as we want to support our international population, we also have to be mindful of any federal regulations or any policies that come forth, and we have to inform our students accurately. And that can be very disheartening at times when we are meeting one-on-one with these individuals. They're not faceless numbers that are perhaps mentioned in various policies. They are people who we get to know. Earlier this week, over the weekend, there was an awful earthquake on the border of Iran and Iraq. Mm-hmm. And I believe it was the most deadly earthquake of the year so far. And we reached out to our students and faculty and staff from those countries to check to see if they needed anything. And we got a lot of correspondence back. And I had one student from Iran say to me that if this had happened in any other year, they would have gone home. They would have made sure, because their family was in an area that was close to the affected zone. And they would have gone home and they would have helped their community and they would have taken a little bit of time off their program. And they said they just feel like they can't do that right now, because regardless of the fact that they may have a valid entry visa, regardless of the fact that they have ties to the United States because they're in a program of study at the University of Illinois, they have no confidence that something isn't going to happen while they're away that would prevent their return. And that's an awful situation to be in, and it's one that we have to agree with. We can look at their immigration documents right now. We can say, look, this has been an awful thing that's happened in your home country. Go. Everything is fine with your studies. Everything is fine with your documents. You are okay to return and you're not going to have any trouble. We should be able to say that. We can't say that because we have no idea what could happen in the next days, weeks, months if they're outside the United States.
And to that end, Martin, what are some of the things the U of I is doing to prepare not just for this travel ban, but other possible new policies like this coming out of the White House? What are you all doing to sort of anticipate all of the changes that may be ahead?
Well, anticipation is a bit dangerous because we don't want to cause concern and say, well, this might happen or this might happen. But since this issue became a major problem in January, the university has formed a work group that consists of not just my office, but the provost office, the chancellor's office, housing, admissions, legal counsel, all of the major players. And we meet every 2 weeks to talk about anything that's happened, rumors that are coming out of Washington. We have a government relations person there to try and make sure that we are as prepared as we can be for any potential changes that are coming out. And so we have a number of contingency plans for certain things that hopefully may never happen.
Yimin, as Martin is talking about this, I want to ask you about the impact on students, because you mentioned graduate students. The Chicago Tribune published a story earlier this week looking at some numbers. I mentioned at the beginning of this conversation, we've got some 52,000 international students enrolled at Illinois colleges. That's last year, and that's 3% more than the year prior, but it's much smaller when you look at what the years it's been in the past, and that was before President Trump took office. So I wonder, Yemin, do you think what's happening in American politics is making it harder for you, for ISU, to recruit students and maybe, and I know you can't necessarily speak to faculty, but from overseas?
Well, from the recruitment side, it's a little challenging to explain the numbers at this moment because given all this have happened just during the past year and happened really fast, and as Martin has expressed that we are trying to get on top of things and try to follow the policies and advise students. So I don't see any data or correlational evidence that shows the recruitment number and the policy environment.
But are again, you hearing, are you hearing anecdotally, or is this something that's perhaps being expressed by families or others?
Well, we all read the news, and, you know, there are some news that includes a lot of quotes and personal stories. And just for students on campus, you know, there are a lot of things going on just this several days. The majority of our international students are graduate students, and we're fortunate enough to give them assistantships. And you know what I'm going to say right now is the possible tax code change would impact on them really huge.
Oh, interesting.
And also, yeah,
yeah, which we were just talking about. Martin, can I ask you something? As you think about the reasons why President Trump said he implemented this policy was for security reasons. And I wonder what you would say to people who might be listening now thinking that we don't want students or graduate faculty from these countries because it could be a security risk to the United States. What's your response to that?
Well, my response to that would be that these individuals already had extensive security checks done. All of the rhetoric that came out that said we want to do background checks and we want to make sure that we are protecting the United States.
And vetting.
And vetting. Mm-hmm. Vetting's being done. From the countries who are on this list more than any others, these students often have had to delay their program by at least a semester, sometimes a year, because of how long it takes to get the entry visa to get into the United States because of the extensive background checks that were already being done. So one of the big problems that happened in January when they just said, you know, we're going to ban individuals from these countries. What you had when it happened, and luckily this ended up being dissolved in the courts, but you had a situation where you could have had two students, we'll say Iran because that was our largest population, we could have had two students from Iran who were in exactly the same program and had gone through exactly the same security checks and vetting and had arrived in the United States having passed all those checks. Then in January, one of them decides to go home for vacation. The other one doesn't. And then this policy came into place, and now it says one of them isn't allowed in the United States because they had this misfortune to travel at this time. So you are basing national security on people's vacation plans, which to me doesn't seem like a particularly wise strategy.
As we wrap up here, I just wonder, Martin, if I could just ask you what you say then to folks who are thinking about coming to the University of Illinois. What do you say about it being a welcoming environment? If you could just answer really briefly.
Well, and I would say that in the United States as a whole, international education is treated very seriously and has great value. Speaking for the University of Illinois, we have long been a leader in this field. We were the first university to create an international student advisor position over 100 years ago. This has always been at the forefront of what the University of Illinois is about, and we hope it will continue to be for the decades to come.
That's Martin McFarlane. I want to thank him from the University of Illinois, as well as Yiming Wong from ISU for joining me. Thank you so much, both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
This is the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for tuning in. For the past three decades, on Friday and Saturday nights in Carbondale, in one parking lot, the line could stretch down the block for bagels. From 9 p.m. to 3 a.m., people were lining up to buy bagels from Winston the Bagel Man Mezzo, selling his hot bagels for locals. And SIU's late-night bar scene, the business had been a community staple. That was until this spring when Winston retired. When he did retire, House representatives in Springfield even introduced a resolution upon that retirement that said, quote, Illinois is a better place as a result of his service. 2 weeks ago, his mantle was taken up by Murfreesboro native Brad Priest. The former baker bought Winston's bagel cart and work van this past Halloween. The name of the new bagel stand is Winston's Bagels by B-Rad. We've got all everybody on the line here to talk about this passing of the mantle, the bagel mantle, we should say, from Carbondale. Winston and Brad are with us, along with SIU student journalist Amelia Blakely. She's a journalism major and a reporter for the Daily Egyptian. Winston, Brad, Amelia, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here with me.
Thank you, Nyla.
Good to be here.
Yeah. Winston, let's start with you. You've been serving hungry SIU students and bagel lovers in Carbondale for the past 34 years. Why did you first open up your business? That was back in 1983, right?
Yeah, about May, if I remember correctly. Of course, I remember more things that didn't happen than did happen at this stage of the game.
Okay. Why did you want to open up a bagel stand?
Give me some structured time.
To give you structured time from 9 p.m. to 3 a.m.?
Yeah, for me it was.
And Winston, why did you come up with the idea of serving bagels?
Well,
where did that come from?
Long story. Make a long story short, a guy had one and showed it to me, but he was working on a PhD, so he wasn't going to stick around, so he kind of gave it to me.
Oh, okay.
The idea to me, now I got my own cart and stuff, but the idea came from a guy named Jim that had a cart, and like I said, he was working on a PhD, so he wasn't going to stick around long, you know, after that.
Okay. Amelia, can you explain for all of us who have not gone to SIU or are not familiar with these bagels in Carbondale, how well-known are Winston's Bagels?
Yeah, so Winston's Bagels are pretty well-known. It's kind of like a folklore thing that even, like, whenever I was a kid, my parents would always tell me about Winston's Bagels, and so that whenever I'd get old enough to stay out in Carbondale, like late at night, that I'd get to try it. And so then, like, as you get into high school, I saw some kids with, like, Winston Bagel t-shirts, and then, of course, you'd always see it on, like, your Snapchats or your Instagram. So it's, like, pretty well known. And especially, like, whenever he retired, you know, I saw Instagram posts and Snapchats.
Yeah, what was the reaction, Amelia, when everyone heard?
Yeah, it was pretty sad. Like, people acted like it was an end of an era, and it kind of was, because it was just something that, especially if, like, your parents had gone to SIU or your, like, family members, you know, it was just something that, like, you got to look forward to. And so, especially for, like, me, last year was my first year at college, so it was like, wow, it's my, you know, first and last year getting to experience Winston's Bagels, besides, like, being in high school, so, you know.
Yeah, so Winston, you serve your bagels with everything, or you used to serve your bagels with everything from cucumbers to onions to raisins. How did you decide what the menu was going to be?
Well, first of all, I decided what I would like on them, and then, which was onions, cucumbers, and bacon bits and garlic salt, butter and cream cheese. So I started with that kind and sunflower seeds, and then I just took a few suggestions.
Over the years, and you added to the menu.
Like
okay.
That.
Yeah.
Like apples and cinnamon and raisins, I added those because a person told me or suggested that I might like somebody might like a sweeter one.
That's Winston Mezzo. He's the bagel man of Carbondale. We're talking about his retirement and the person who's bought his business. Brad Priest is with us. He's now the owner of what's called Winston's Bagel by B-Rad. Brad, can you tell us about how you bought Winston's Bagel business, the equipment, about 2 weeks ago? How did you come across with it?
Well, my wife's a local in the area, and she came across it, and I was stay-at-home dad for about 5 years, and my daughter just started kindergarten. And she said, you know, this would be a fun thing, see, because I used to bake down in Nashville for a little while. And at first I thought, well, that sounds kind of silly. And then I really, really sat down with her. I said, you know, Winston's a great guy, and she gave him a call. She knew him from years ago. She was a business owner with her father down in the Carbondale area, so Winston was an icon in the area. I said, well, let's give him a call. So we went and met with him, and he's such a great guy, and he told me how much fun it was, and, well, here I am.
Here you are. So, Winston, can I ask, how much fun was it to be open from 9 p.m. to 3 a.m., whether it was rain or sleet or snow? Why did you keep doing that for 34 years?
Well, the short answer is money.
Yeah, it worked out pretty well. The money part was good for you. Anything else?
We got two carts, two sites. After a while, I ran two sites. And to make a long story short, it was fun and profit. You know, for fun and profit.
For fun, yeah. I imagine. Did you get to know some of the students or develop relationships with students over the years, Winston?
Yeah, because I've known some of them from their day one. You know, when they came in as a freshman and left as a senior.
Right, and
of course,
so
most of them were just a face in the crowd. You know.
Yeah, because there were so many of them. Amelia, can I ask you? As you did have a small opportunity to sample Winston's bagels, what were your favorite toppings? What did you like?
I really digged the like cream cheese with apples and then like having, I think it was brown sugar on top or maybe it was cinnamon. It was either one of those. And that was really good because I'm like kind of a picky eater. So I didn't really venture out to like having bacon bits or cucumbers on my bagels. But yeah, I definitely enjoyed the more simple bagels.
And Brad, what's on offer now for Winston's Bagels by B-Rad? Are you keeping the same menu?
Exactly the same menu. I was trained by the master, so why change anything? There's no reason to change anything. And that's also why I kept the name. That's why it's Winston's Bagels by B-Rad. I don't want to change a thing. I want to keep on the legacy and obviously keep on the menu.
And, Brad, can you tell us about what style of bagels are these? What makes them special?
Well, they're charcoal broiled, first of all. You can't find a charcoal broiled bagel anywhere in the country that I know of. I've been around the country. I was in the military for a little while. I've been around the world a little bit. I've never seen anything like this.
So explain, yeah. So they're charcoal broiled. Winston, maybe you can hop in here and tell us, how did you come up with that idea that you have the bagels and then you have them on a grill?
Yeah, that's right. We just charcoal grilled, just plain old charcoal. Just heat them up. They're already, of course, cooked when we get them.
Right. Brad, as you said, you got to know Winston a little bit. He gave you some secrets of the trade. Are there any tips you can share with us?
Well, I'll tell you what. Winston, he sat with me the first couple of days, and he made sure I did everything right. I mean, from unloading the truck to setting up the cart to loading the truck. There's a process to it. And believe it or not, it's a little more detailed than I imagined. It's a little more work in the background, setting everything up in the background at your commissary and making sure that everything is ready to go before you go. So you have to understand a lot of these little things and the way to do things to make the process work correctly, plus the speed. I don't have Winston's speed yet, but I'll tell you that. He's a machine. I'm not a machine yet. I'm trying to be a machine.
And so Brad is a machine. When you say that, how fast, how many bagels are you selling an evening then?
Well, I'm doing very well. I don't exactly know the numbers right now, but I know Winston can take orders four or five people back. I'm around one or two. So he can remember people four or five people back and have those orders ready to go. But I am quite a bit of a rookie when it comes to learning this process.
Right.
And it has been fun, and Winston has been fantastic training me.
Amelia, how long do people normally wait in line for these bagels?
Oh, I'd say the few times I waited may have been like 15 minutes, but I've also heard people say that they've waited like 2 hours, like whenever the lines are really long. I think it just depends on like probably the weather and then who's all out on the town that night.
Right. So, Brad, as you've been operating, you've got some great tips from Winston. As you've been getting up and running, have you had any challenges in the first couple of weeks of being in business?
Not at all. Just a little bit of an issue with Carbondale and I. We're gonna work that out, and I'll be there soon.
Right. So Brad, is that a licensing issue in terms of where you're able to operate?
Well, yeah, they require leases now where you operate, so I have to work that out, and I want to be mobile, so I'm just going to work that out with some individuals in the city and make sure I get down to Carbondale itself as soon as possible.
Winston, I have to ask you, what have you been doing in your retirement? Do you miss the bagel cart?
I miss the action down there. I don't miss the 4 o'clock in the morning, and as you mentioned before, the rain, snow, sleet, or hail. I don't miss that, but I do miss the action. I love those kids. I don't have any kids of my own, but I miss those kids and interacting with those kids down there. But like I said, I don't miss that 4 o'clock in the morning. It was getting old. It was getting pretty old for me.
Yeah, and are you back on a regular sleep schedule, or do you find that you're still after 30 years?
I'm kind of getting there. I slept in about 8 o'clock this morning, went to bed about 11 p.m.
So what's the retirement plan for you? What's the retirement plan for you now, Winston?
Well, I'm big at the rec here. I've always worked out that I can extend that a little bit more. That is, I can come on the weekends now. Swim and do a little weight training and cycling. And, of course, I'm big in AA. I'm a recovering alcoholic.
And that was a right. And that sobriety. Was a big part of your sobriety, right? This bagel cart.
Right. Mm-hmm. Working that, going to meetings, then leaving. The meeting got over at 9. That's one reason we set up at 9.
Ah, all right. Well, I
we
know that
the meeting that get over at 9, and we'd set up at 9 and work to whenever. But I work with sponsees. I work with people that just come in the program, newer people, and like I said, expanded my AA too. So.
It sounds like it was a great program for you and to help you with your program.
It's not for everybody.
But it worked.
Everybody, but
right.
It saved my life. You know?
And Winston, thank you for sharing with us.
35 years fighting.
That's amazing. So, Winston, thanks for sharing that with us. Thanks for sharing your bagels with Carbondale.
It's been my pleasure.
That's Winston Mezzo. I want to thank him as well as Brad Priest, who's now the owner of Winston's Bagel by B-Rad, and SIU sophomore and Daily Egyptian reporter Amelia Blakely. Thanks for being with me, guys.
Yeah, thank you.
That does it for us today, but before we go, on Friday we have a special show planned to help you get ready for Thanksgiving. We've been talking about bagels. On Friday, we're going to be broadcasting live from the Spice House in Chicago. I'm a baker, so when it comes to spices, of course, nutmeg is one of my favorites, especially this time of year. What about you? We have rounded up some experts who are going to answer your questions, whether you want to talk spices, baking, turkey. We'd love to hear what you have to say. If you have questions about cooking, baking, or carving, or if you want to share something with our audience, you can leave us a voicemail. Our phone number is 217-300-2121. That's 217-300-2121. You can email us at talk@21stshow.org. Or we're on Twitter. As always, our handle is 21stshow. So share your Thanksgiving tips, or if you have questions for us, we're going to have lots of folks on hand to answer. That's going to be on Friday. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm broadcasting today from the Medill Graduate School of Journalism in downtown Chicago. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.